The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly for August the 25th. I'm Alok Jha. Because it's summer and because last week's show on music and the brain didn't have one, this show is going to be dedicated entirely to the news jam. We're going to go through and analyse all the top stories from the past week and perhaps a bit more with the Guardian science correspondent James Randerson, environment correspondent David Adam and religious affairs correspondent Riazat Butt. Without any further ado, here's that news ident.
News jam.
British forces could soon be launching teams of autonomous spy robots to scope out enemy-held towns and villages. The technology was developed for the Ministry of Defence's Grand Challenge, a contest to find the best robotic air and ground vehicles for identifying threats such as snipers and roadside bombs. The winners were Team Stellar, who used a 7-kilo robotic plane to first map a village before launching similar 1.8-kilo robots to fly between the buildings and take video and thermal images.
Engineers have unveiled the latest design for the European Space Agency's ExoMars rover. The finished version of the six-wheeled robot, known as Bradley, will operate autonomously on the Red Planet. It's due to touch down in 2015 as part of a €1 billion mission that ESA scientists hope will match the success of the two NASA rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, which landed on Mars in January 2004 and are still operating.
Doctors will use genetic data to give patients personalised treatments, claim researchers at the institute sponsored by the genome pioneer Craig Venter. The study says genetic data will be more accurate than referring to a person's race in order to prescribe certain drugs. The scientists used data from the gene sequences of the only two people to have had their genomes read, Venter and James Watson, the co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, to bolster their case that using race to predict adverse reactions to drugs could be misleading.
And finally, chronic back pain could be eased through teaching better posture via the Alexander technique, doctors said. A study published in the British Medical Journal looked at 500 people that had been taught the technique, which aligns the head, neck and back muscles. The patients reported less pain and a better quality of life after taking up the technique. Some said they were able to do things that had previously been difficult for them, such as walking normally, getting out and about and doing household jobs.
Thank you, Riazat and David, for the vocal talents on the jam. Now let's get to some of the analysis. And for that, heavyweight science correspondent sitting right opposite me, James, you wrote about the MOD Grand Challenge, did a video on it, but we'll come back to that later. Tell us about what this is.
Well, it's a big contest that is loosely based on the kind of the DARPA Grand Challenge. Now, DARPA are the defense agency run by Pentagon in the US, and they've had various challenges to develop military technology. And this one is all about developing a group of spy robots that can operate autonomously, go into villages and towns, scope them out for threats like snipers, etc., come back or send the information back to base. And so basically you don't have to send your own soldiers in to get shot up by the enemy. All very well, you know, really interesting competition and stuff. But I mean, the kind of whole idea is rather than going for the big defense contractors, you try and get to some of those small companies, university groups, but also quite controversially, I think, schools involved to try and bring in some ideas. Now, I don't know what anyone else thinks about this, but, you know, should we really have sort of 12, 13-year-old kids involved in this?
It's a good point, actually. Let's put a pin in that kid thing just for a second there. What kinds of things were there in the competition? I mean, I was quite surprised by how open it was. I mean, they let you video, you could walk around. These are all potentially quite interesting military technologies. I mean, they seem quite open about it. Is that the case?
They were open about it to the extent that, yes, we were allowed to see all of the technology that was there. There were 11 teams and, you know, we had access to all of them. The day itself was incredibly stage managed, which was quite frustrating from the point of view of trying to report on it. But then that sort of applies to everything.
So what kind of things are you talking about?
Well, it's things like model helicopters, sort of effectively kind of model buggies or model cars, driving around with cameras on the top, something that looked like a mini JCB. There was even a mini flying saucer.
A what?
A mini flying saucer. Use the Coanda effect to fly.
I don't know what that means. But somebody else, you've got a question.
I've got a question. I'm quite intrigued that they're relying on school-aged children to design what could be quite sophisticated military technology to wipe out villages in Afghanistan and Iraq. But did you see any evidence of yoghurt pots and sticky back plastic? What were they using?
The technology was actually, you know, incredibly impressive, a lot of it, because it was able to fly autonomously without, you know, it's not being remote controlled. It can plot its own route from A to B and that kind of stuff. To be honest, the kids' involvement was more, I think, sort of cosmetic. It was more about education and trying to get kids involved in science, that kind of
villages in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Their argument was that actually these robots are not involved in the destroying villages bit. They're involved in the
identifying villages to destroy.
No, identifying nasty people in villages to be shot by our boys, basically. So their argument is, you know, send in a robot and it means a life is saved, a soldier's life is saved, and you know I can see that argument, but. It's still, you know, you're encouraging, even if the kids don't have a sort of very direct involvement in the final product, you're still involving sort of 12-year-old kids in what is essentially, you know, military technology. I actually made this point on a blog, and at the end sort of said, you know, am I just being a woolly liberal or is there something in this? And the first blogger kindly said, no, you're not being a woolly liberal, you're just being a drip.
I was just interested in James's comment that it was a mini flying saucer. I mean, how big are flying saucers anyway?
And are big ones the only ones that count?
Typically, they have to be big enough to fit human-sized aliens in. This one wasn't that
talking
big.
Talking of potential aliens, Mars rovers, James, the Bradley, the potential ExoMars rover. Tell us a bit about the ExoMars mission.
Well, the idea is to send a probe out to Mars that will map the surface. There's an orbiter which will map the surface and decide where to land. And then they're going to send down a rover, a six-wheeled rover that, rather like Spirit and Opportunity, will move around and dig up soil samples and you know, carry out analysis, take pictures, etc. But the difference with this rover is that rather than the current rovers, it's a kind of painfully slow operation because they really are zooped up remote control cars on Mars. You know, you sort of go right, go left a bit. You send that instruction, it takes half an hour to get to Mars. The rover moves left a bit. It sends back an image of where it's got to. That goes back to you. You go, okay, right, we're where we thought we are. Right, now go right a bit. With the ExoMars rover, the idea is that it's autonomous. You say, find the best way to get from where we are now to that point.
There's
over there.
Something quite, this dovetails quite nicely with the MOD stuff, doesn't it? Because the MOD military technology at the moment, it's all about autonomous machines. So do people like ESA, do you know if they use stuff like the military hardware or that technology?
Well, I mean, the company that's developing this at the moment for ESA is EADS Astrium, which is also a defence company.
Big defence company. Make warplanes.
Exactly.
So I'm assuming, yeah.
I suspect there's a lot of read-through in expertise between the two.
Final one before we move on to some other stuff from the past few weeks. DNA to prescribe drugs. This is some research coming out of the J. Craig Venter Institute. Now, Craig Venter, not one for keeping quiet about his work normally. This research sort of suggests that actually personalised medicine is closer than we think and it's going to be very useful. James, do you want to just take us through a couple of his points?
Well, it's just a nice illustration of the fact that at the moment, some drugs can be prescribed based on ethnicity. And there's some suggestion that certain ethnic groups are more likely to have certain groups of genes which are involved in breaking down drugs. And so if you have a gene that breaks down a drug faster, then you want to use more of that drug in that patient. If it breaks something down slow, you want to use less. And if you don't use less, then you run the risk of an adverse drug reaction because they might have a kind of overdose of the drug. So, you know, there's some quite potentially serious consequences of this. So what they did was they went in and looked, rather than just imagining relying on race or ethnicity as a kind of guide, they went in some detail and looked at Craig Venter and James Watson's genome and looked at specifically at some of these genes involved. And Watson's genome has a version of one of these genes, which is very, very uncommon in Caucasians. Only about 3% of people have it, and it's much more common in Southeast Asians. And so if you are making your prescribing decision based on his ethnicity, you'd get it wrong. And that's their point, that we should, now that we're starting to get some of this genetic data, we should stop relying on ethnicity, because it's a very broad brush tool which is not that effective.
This idea of ethnicity being an influencing factor in how physicians prescribe things, and that's very recent anyway. I mean, it's not like we've been doing this for a long time.
No. I mean, the classic one is Bidil,
the heart drug.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. But yeah, we haven't been doing it for very long, but it's
already been usurped.
Yes, exactly that.
It's really hard to actually, you know, prescribe based on race anyway. Prescribing based on genetics is going to be even more complicated because there are more genes.
But potentially more precise once you understand what's going on.
It's a huge thing for the drug industry, because they have all these drugs that they've found side effects in, and so they're not widely prescribed. And what they think is that if they can find, if there's a genetic reason for some people having an adverse reaction, and then they can target it much better. It's all about targeting. And the reason that race comes into it is because race, I think, is used as a shortcut for genetic targeting. And so then these researchers are trying to say, well, look, it's not as simple as that. You know, if you're going to do this, you have to do it properly. You can't just take someone's skin colour or ethnicity as an excuse to give them a certain type of drug. You have to genetically profile them properly, because it's only skin deep.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
As regular listeners will know, there was no news jam last week, so we're going to use this opportunity to bring you up to date with a couple of the more interesting tales that we haven't covered in the past few weeks. We're going to start off with Prince Charles. Now, Prince Charles said that genetically modified crops and agribusiness were the biggest environmental disaster. He even sort of alluded to the fact that there might be something to do with climate change. It was covered widely because Prince Charles seems to have a following. Some people said that he was absolutely right. Others decry his scientific illiteracy. Do you want to just take us through this debate? I mean, I don't think we should on this podcast necessarily come down on it one way or the other. But take us through what Prince Charles said, and then some of the arguments for and against.
Prince Charles gave an interview to the Daily Telegraph. It was videoed, which is part of the reason this was such a strong story, I think. And as we probably know, Prince Charles is no great fan of what you would call modern farming methods, be it GM or otherwise. And I think he's a big organic farmer, and I think he has a vision of that's the way that we should go in the future. So we knew that already, but in this interview, he seemed to take a broad side at pretty much everything that was, in his words, sort of agribusiness. You know, the sort of the commercialization and the large corporations getting involved with farming and food production. As part of that, he had a very dismissive view of genetic modification. You can read his words to say that it could cause possibly one of the world's greatest environmental disasters. As you can imagine, there was a whole load of outraged scientists and a whole load of very pleased anti-GM campaigners who then tuned into what the prince had said and took elements of it and then used it as a platform to support their own views. And so what you then ended up with was sort of the classic debate between pro-GM and anti-GM campaigners. And actually what the prince has said was largely irrelevant. They just sort of used it to get behind their existing battle lines and sling mud at each other and at the prince in the case of the scientists.
So who were the couple of people? I mean, our very own John Vidal stepped in to support the prince on Comet is Free. What was his...
John did. What John's point was that if you take, rather than take the rhetoric of what he said, actually look at his words and break it down into clauses, actually, as John did, and said, look, this bit he said, this is what he means, this is what you can interpret it. And John took a very sort of lenient view, almost, of what the prince was saying. And then I think a few of the other scientists sort of took it very literally and said, look, this is what he said about this particular technology. That's clearly not supported by the evidence. And I think one of the problems is we've got a little bit of what happens with the media nowadays. Prince Charles gives a very broad-ranging interview. And clearly, if you look at his words, he isn't referring to genetic crops as they're produced at the moment. He's talking about his fear of just sort of the scientific takeover of food production, not necessarily of the specific GM crops. But then, of course, that's not a story. What's a story is Prince Charles slags off GM.
One of the other articles on Comet is Free was by a scientist, Henry Miller, who sort of took Charles's points point by point and demolished them on a scientific point of view, and said that he essentially said that he hadn't listened to the latest science, and kind of he was just being actually, what was the title of the piece? It was something like the Dunce of Wales.
Yes, exactly.
Which is a bit harsh, but you can understand his frustration. You can understand his frustration in that, once again, a technology which can be used for good things and can be used for providing food for places in the world where they can't grow for whatever reason, or there's droughts and there's poverty. It's a potentially useful thing. It's before it's been given a chance to work. It's being criticised by so-called rich agriculturalists like Prince Charles. You can understand his frustration with that.
I can understand the frustration, yeah. But I just think we run the risk of taking what Prince Charles said too literally. I think what he was trying to do was he was having a rhetorical attack. Like if he'd said, oh, Prince William gets me so angry sometimes I could strangle him, you know, we wouldn't accuse him of
wanting to kill his kids.
Of wanting to kill his children, precisely. And I just think there are genuine concerns about how GM could be applied in the developing world. This is the other issue, of course, because it's used hugely in the developed world, and this is something the green groups don't always own up to. And there haven't been a great number of problems, you know, because the farmers are rich enough and it does seem to cut pesticide use, although the figures are disputed and so on and so on. But then when you look at, is that model applicable to the developing world? And you get into all sorts of more interesting issues. The issue isn't necessarily about the environmental damage that the crops themselves will cause, but more about the method of growing them and relying on corporations to provide seed and to provide the chemicals. Because effectively, in the developed world, the GM is just a way to sell chemicals. It's a way to sell pesticides.
Well, you can read all those articles we've mentioned by John Vidal and Henry Miller, and also a bit more of the coverage about Prince Charles's comments on the Environment website. That's guardian.co.uk/environment. Just to sort of sweep together all the other ragbag of things that we've been up to, what have you been doing the last couple of weeks? Where have you been with your pod recorder?
Well, one of the places I've been is to see a company called TMO Renewables down near Guildford. And actually, it's on an airfield that's next to where they record Top Gear, interestingly. This company have a bacterium that they've developed, a few genetic tweaks to it. Normally, it lives on compost heaps, but they've done a bit of work with it. And it's able to make ethanol, bioethanol, out of all sorts of substances, but particularly good at making it out of cellulose. Now, this means that the second generation of biofuels that everyone's always talking about, these sort of woody plants which are not food, so you wouldn't have to compete with food plants, potentially you can start making bioethanol out of them. And I spoke to Hamish Curran, who's the CEO of the company.
Well, we're standing on top of the pre-treatment system, which utilises high-pressure steam to disrupt the structure of biomass. Any type of biomass that's fed into the facility is disrupted with steam, and that allows the start of the pulping process, which ultimately becomes ethanol.
You mentioned that this is second-generation biofuels. What does that mean, and why is it so important?
Essentially, it means biofuels from non-foodstuffs. So we make ethanol in this factory from wheat straw, wood chips, distillers used grains, miscanthus, all these non-food biomass materials. It completely eliminates the debate about food versus fuel. For instance, in the UK, we could use the straw that comes with the process of growing wheat and make biofuels without doing any change of land use and without disrupting the food supply chain.
People have been trying to do this sort of thing for quite a while. What's clever about the process that you've got here and the bacteria that you've got to do it?
Historically, ethanol is made with yeast, and of course to get ethanol from yeast you have to feed pure sugar, and the process of brewing beer or making fuel ethanol from with yeast always involves the sugar. Our organism, which is a bacteria, makes ethanol from complex biomass derived long chain sugars, not glucose. That means that the abundant biomass in the world, the grass cuttings from your backyard or the straw from a field, can automatically be digested into a useful biofuel, bioethanol. The existing fuel ethanol industry in the United States, which makes ethanol from corn, has a byproduct called distiller's grains. This byproduct is currently used as animal feed. It's a low-value, low-grade animal feed. It's full of cellulose. It's a cellulose-rich material. And because it has to be dried for sale to animals, their consumption of energy is massive. Our process will take that spent grain in a wet form and turn it into more ethanol.
That was Hamish Curran of TMO Renewables. You can read more about that story at guardian.co.uk/science. This is a special newsy edition of the Science Weekly podcast from The Guardian. Let's move on now to the blogs. There's been plenty of activity there with the science team feverishly posting away. James, you've written a post about a very interesting creationist from the world of Islam. Tell us a bit about him and then we'll go over to Riazat to explain to us who this character is.
He's an interesting character, yeah. His name's Harun Yahya, or if you prefer, Adnan Oktar.
I prefer the second one.
Well, that's his real name. I don't know. I'm not quite sure why he uses the pseudonym. But anyway, he's written a book called The Atlas of Creation, and it's a four-volume tome, lavishly produced, amazing pictures. Rather preposterous, but an interesting book nonetheless. And he sent these books out in their thousands to academics all across Europe a couple of years ago, which must have cost an absolute fortune, because they really are expensively produced books, not to mention the postage. And he has challenged Richard Dawkins to a debate. Now, of course, Dawkins is going to say no, because Dawkins has vowed not to enter into these things. And anyway, you can read all about it on the blog, but I particularly liked it sort of descended into a row between Suntory Boss and Aracro, but apart from all of that, Give Peace a Chance said, "I'm just floored by the content of this article. Yahya gets the truth out there about the Piltdown Man hoax, and once again Dawkins refuses to explain himself or defend his position. Thanks for telling me about the Atlas of Creation. I will order a copy now."
No, let's just get a bit of a skinny on who this guy actually is. Riazat, who is Harun Yahya? And where does he get all his money from?
Well, this is the thing. Harun Yahya is a pen name. Some people think that it's the pen name of a group of writers who put together words for this preposterous, lavishly illustrated 786-page volume on debunking evolution. He's actually not a scientist. He has no scientific qualifications. He's an interior designer by trade. It's like Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen. But bigger.
Much bigger.
I met him. Yeah, this is the thing. We have actually filmed an interview with him and we've recorded an interview with him.
So he's rich.
Well, I don't know if he's rich, but he has incredibly wealthy people banking him. The thing about Turkey is that it now has more billionaires than America. So there's a huge amount of money sloshing around in Turkey. And I get the feeling that he's funded by a very small group of people. And that's really all he needs.
So what is his shtick? He is a Muslim who wants to show that, Allah created the world in this way?
Yes, that's basically it. That there's no such thing as evolution and that Dawkins and Darwin are wrong.
Is creationism, is this sort of the standard thing about creationism, is it in Islam this sort of seen the same way as, say, for example, Christians see creation? I mean, what's the sort of story there?
Well, I did challenge him as much as you can challenge someone through a translator. And I said, "Is this intelligent design?" And he said, "Yes." And then he denied it 5 minutes later. and he couldn't really quite explain why this was Islamic creationism as opposed to any other kind of creationism. But all he kept doing was pointing at pictures of fossils saying, you know, "I will give you 10 trillion Turkish lira to prove that evolution exists." And I thought, well, I'm not a scientist, but I'm sure I could find that out for you.
This is a bit sad. It's almost like Islam wants its own version of creationism. It's like, look, the Christians have got their intelligent design. They're making lots of sorts of noises about it. Let's have one ourselves.
Can I just give the final word to Alter Boy, who said, "Dawkins will no doubt respond to Yahya's call with the words of a scientific colleague he quotes in The God Delusion. That would look great on your CV, not so good on mine."
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
We move from one slightly crackpot idea about creationism to a slightly crackpot medical idea, homeopathy. We talk about this a lot. Ian Sample posted on the Science blog the idea that sort of pharmacists tell their sort of patients who are buying pills and things from them that homeopathy doesn't work or there's no scientific basis for it. And this is on the back of Edzard Ernst's letter to the Royal College of Pharmacologists, sort of trying to encourage them to do exactly that. We encouraged quite a nice little debate on the blogs. I'll read out some of the comments. Bob Rayner said, "Is it too much to ask that pharmacies stick to selling things that actually work? I'd like to see more emphasis on real treatments with real medical properties rather than massively diluted snake oil." Saturday Reader actually sort of agreed with that generally and said that homeopaths have no medical training and therefore do not recognise when they're out of their depth. This, allied with a Blair-like belief in what they're selling, can be downright dangerous. Given pharmacists' medical knowledge, it could be argued that it's safer for them to sell these magic pills, but frankly, regulation of the entire homeopathic industry can't come soon enough. And just to round it off with someone who's a fan of homeopathy, Fuzzy Fez, he or she said, "Why shouldn't homeopathy be available? I use it. I'm fully aware of the sides of the argument and fully aware of what goes into producing the remedies. I'm also a taxpayer and funder of the NHS. Why should chemicals, with all their side effects, be the only solution that I, in effect, am paying for? Why should they be the only things they're offered?" Any thoughts on this, Pod?
Water's a chemical.
Drugs are good.
Apart from that one, drugs are good, okay, yeah. Is that all you have to say?
Sorry, that just gets up my nose, that one.
We don't need to discuss homeopathy any further. Another of Ian's posts on the blog was quite interesting. It was about research published in Nature and Science a couple of weeks ago on nanomaterials that can be made into an invisibility cloak. And the only thing I'll say about this is there's an excellent comment on one of the blogs, and it said, Limini said, "Someone needs to contact Arnie. The Predator could do this back in 1987. He's absolutely right. The Predator could do all of this stuff. I've seen it in films. It must be true. We're going to leave all of that there. You can find all those blog posts, stories and other bits of gossip on guardian.co.uk/science and guardian.co.uk/environment. Thanks to James Randerson, Riyazat Butt and David Adam for helping me navigate the science stories this week. Science Weekly was produced by Scott Corley and Andy Duckworth this week. I'm Alok Jha. There'll be more Science Weekly soon.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.